Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with the Park City School District Superintendent of Wellness, Ben Belknap, talking about vaping in our schools. Park City Interim City Manager Matt Dias will be previewing Tuesday's Park City Council meeting. And finally, an update with Brian Hanton. He's the director of the Snyderville Basin Special Recreation District. Again, a truth and taxation hearing is being proposed. And while Utah officials are reacting to the vaping epidemic happening with our young people, locally school districts also addressing the issue. In the studio to explain what the Park City School District is doing, I have the Superintendent of Wellness, Ben Belknap. Good morning.
Good morning.
So any idea of how big of a problem vaping is in the Park City schools?
Yeah, it is a big deal. We just got our SHARP survey back, the data from our SHARP survey last year. And essentially, yeah, it's shown us that it's a big deal. Our rates have tripled here in Summit County since 2011. The survey, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, though, those are students who respond that they use vaping equipment?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. About 20% of our students, grades 8 to 12, report that they've tried it at least once. And interestingly, about a third of those who reported having used in the previous month before the survey reported that they had, they've never tried a cigarette, which kind of leads us to this idea that perhaps, you know, there still is this belief among our teenagers and adults, frankly, too, that vaping is not as harmful as smoking a cigarette, which we're finding is not the case.
And do those SHARP survey results talk about the difference between those kids using vaping equipment for nicotine versus THC?
It does. I don't have the exact numbers there in front of me. We do know that it is much more accessible, the THC is, through vaping devices. We know now with legalization just across the border in Nevada that it's a lot more accessible for our students here, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, just like smoking, I think a lot of people do know vaping isn't safe, but now we know it's even more dangerous just given that the product is being purchased online from unreputable sources. I mean, what's the school district doing about the education of that?
Sure. So we have incorporated a curriculum in our health classes starting in Ecker Hill about vaping and the harms of it. We get into the details of the chemicals that are in the juices that our kids are vaping. Our elementary counselors have a curriculum that they deliver to our kids, you know, even as young as elementary school. They go into each classroom and talk about the harms of it. We have our counselors at the high school and at Treasure Mountain are incorporating this Prime for Life, which is a preventative drug prevention program. For our kids. So we are doing a lot of things. Also, we have several school personnel that are working with a parent education group through Communities That Care, and they are working to develop tools to equip parents, with the things that they need to identify signs with their children, things that they can do to help, you know, also in the home, educate their kids on the harms of this.
Yeah, you mentioned that kids believe it to be safer than smoking. I mean, do they believe there are some risks associated with it, though?
Yeah, I think the more reports that are coming out now in the news about people getting hurt, that kind of stuff, that I think we're seeing more of a realization that it's harmful. But there still is this pervasive belief that, yeah, it's bad for you, but it could be worse. It could be cigarettes, you know, and I think we're finding that to not be the case.
Yeah. So where is this happening? Is it in the classrooms? It is in the restrooms? It's in the cars?
So most of our problems are happening at the high school, generally in cars off campus, often at lunchtime, you know, which is kind of an issue we're struggling with. But yeah, it's happening in the bathrooms. Now, I also don't want to give this idea that it's just a big, you know, smoke out hot box in our bathrooms, you know. But there have been a few instances where we have you know, found kids that have been vaping in the bathrooms. A couple of instances, and this is, you know, the difficult thing. It's difficult to detect. There are some instances where we've caught kids actually in the classroom kind of dispelling the vape into their hoods or their sweaters, and you know, it's difficult to detect.
Yeah, so does the school district have a policy that dictates about vaping?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's part of our Safe Schools policy, and if a student is caught, then they get a Safe School violation, which could lead up to a 10 to 180-day suspension or expulsion from the school district. That goes in front of a hearing officer, which is myself, and we address it that way. Of course, our goal is not to respond with punitive measures, but more with educational measures for our students.
Yeah, so we've kind of done away with those zero-tolerance policies regarding drugs?
We're trying to get away from that, just recognizing that there's a bigger issue going on, and that if a student is vaping at school, you know, we have to take into account the addiction piece, and we're not doing that child any favors by kicking them out of our school district. Now, of course, our goal is to keep all students safe, and if it's an issue of distribution, then we're going to act a lot differently. But our ultimate goal is to not catch our kids in the act and punish them, but to educate them on the harms of it.
Yeah. You mentioned you're seeing the problem at the high school. Are we seeing vaping happening at Ecker at this point at all?
You know what? Unfortunately, we have had a couple of instances just in the last couple of years at Ecker Hill. That's really, obviously really alarming.
Yeah. Again, is it the nicotine or is it the THC, or do we know?
We've had, I can't confidently get into specific numbers, but primarily it's been nicotine.
Yeah. So are the vape products as easy to get as cigarettes might be?
I can't speak with a lot of authority on that, but it does appear to be, that appears to be the case. They're selling, you know, you can get these in gas stations and in smoke shops, just like cigarettes. And I think all it takes is, you know, a child with a connection to an irresponsible adult who's willing to purchase these things for them. And, you know, I do want to highlight, though, that the local smoke shops and gas stations have been really good working with us and with law enforcement on identifying, you know, those times when perhaps someone's purchasing these products for a minor. And they're very good about IDing and really, they're really cracking down on it.
Yeah. Wasatch County School District, as we've reported, has installed vape detectors. Is this Park City School District going to do the same?
Yes. In fact, our safety committee and our new chief operations officer, Mike Tanner, has really spearheaded this. And they explored several types of devices, but we finally settled on one. And we're going to install these at Ecker Hill, Treasure Mountain, and the high school over the winter break. So the ones that, you know, I think the biggest hurdle in identifying which one was to make sure it was compatible with our IT system and that kind of thing. But they settled on one that's called the Halo device. And what this does is it detects moisture, vapor, smoke. And interestingly, it also detects loud noises and like language that is consistent with bullying and fighting. So I don't know how that works exactly, but what happens is when it detects any of those things, it sends an alert through text message to, you know, whomever is on the receiving end of that. It'll usually be a school resource officer and an administrator at the school, and then they can respond however needed.
Okay, and these are going to be installed where?
They're going to be installed in the bathrooms where most of the action, so to speak, has been in each of the schools.
Okay, so not every bathroom, just a couple of them?
So we're going to start out, because the installation is pretty cumbersome because having to link it into the IT system, we're going to start out with a few at each location, and then over the summer we'll add more.
Yeah, so, and again, I mean, not to be punitive, but what, just to deter? Is that the idea behind this?
Yeah, that would be the ideal goal. And, you know, there's been some talk on different committees about, like, well, maybe we shouldn't tell anybody that we're installing these. But the goal isn't to, you know, entrap these kids. The goal is to let them know, hey, it's, you know, we're doing what we can to find this. And if we can deter them from using in the first place, absolutely. And if we do get an alert, then again, that's hopefully someone that we can catch early in the process and help them before it becomes an addiction.
Yeah. Let's do a quick follow-up with regard to the Learning Academy. I'm hearing kind of different things, that we've got only 7 students actually in there, but a full-time staff?
Sure. So we had 11 students, and we're bringing in a few more here coming in term 2. And this was understood. We do have a full staff there, and this was from the onset. We understood this would be the process. The process would be it would be slowly build, and that this year it would not, you know, as we get a referral process in place, and as our teachers work with us on that, it's going to be a slow build. We by the end of the year we anticipate to have 50 to 60 students. We went into this eyes wide open, knowing that it would be kind of a longer term approach.
Right, and so it's an every other day program, right?
Correct.
So, the kids are there two or three times. The 11 kids are there at the Learning Academy two or three times a week, depending on the schedule, and then get put back into the high school on those off days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that's part of the concern from the teachers that I'm hearing is that it's now kind of overburdening the high school classes, that we've got class sizes over 30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So our teachers, we had from the beginning of the school year, students who had been in the Learning Center last year, we sent 25 to 30 students back over to the high school. At any given time, we have 70 classes going on at the high school, so we're looking at an increase in class size by a half a student. Our teachers on those off days are going into the classes with those students to help the teachers however they can, follow up with the students on the assignments they're missing, that kind of stuff.
So you're telling me that the class sizes aren't necessarily any bigger than they were last year?
Oh, the class sizes are bigger, but when we look at the numbers, that if it's a burden coming bringing on Learning Center students, we're looking at, yeah.
The class sizes aren't bigger as a result of the Learning
exactly.
Academy.
Exactly.
They're just bigger because there's more kids in them.
That's right.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about in terms of meeting, because the Learning Academy in years past has kind of tried to meet the needs of really alternate education students. And it seems like we've kind of tried to farm those back into the high school. So how is that working? I mean, are we truly meeting the needs of the kids that need an alternative education?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our goal obviously is to meet the needs of every student. What we are up against, and this is kind of a flaw in the traditional alternative education model, is that every child has a civil right to be educated in the least possible restrictive environment. And if we do not have a solid referral process that shows that we have supported this student to the best of our capabilities in the high school, whether it's through in a general education class or in smaller class sizes and through remediation, that kind of thing, that if we just say, oh, this kid's just not working out in my class, I'm going to make a phone call and get them over into this alternative education setting, that's a violation of that student's civil rights. So we're trying to essentially reset this model to be sure that we've got all the supports in place in the high school, so we know that the students there are there because they are truly alternative education students and not just students that maybe are a little bit more difficult to manage in class or something like that the teachers, have traditionally been able to refer to a counselor who then can refer to the alternative school.
Yeah. In years past, too, we've had pregnant teens part of the Learning Academy. We've had kids with issues with drugs and such. Are those still coming to the Learning Academy, those type of students?
Yeah, we definitely have an option for those students. So there are several different ways that students can come into the Learning Center, and that is definitely would be one. One primary thing is we look at, is the student in a crisis right now? Like a teen pregnancy, we would consider that. And in those events, the process is not so arduous for our teachers to demonstrate that they've done, A, B, and C, unsuccessfully before they can move them over. So that definitely isn't a faster avenue for those types of students.
Okay. So you think you're going to add how many then?
We expect to have a 50 to 60, hopefully by the end of the year and for sure in years moving forward.
Okay. Anything else, Ben, you want to mention?
No, I just appreciate you taking the time for me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ben Belknap, again, the Assistant Superintendent of Wellness at Park City School District. Well, the Park City Council meeting tomorrow instead of Thursday for its regular meeting. In the studio with a preview, I have Interim City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the agenda says that tomorrow's meeting is a regular meeting. Is that part of some of your new direction, changing the regular meeting again from Thursday to Tuesday? I know that we had kind of dabbled in that earlier.
No, it's not. And I think over years we've dabbled back and forth to try to find the perfect day and the perfect time. But this was because we have a Colorado Association of Ski Towns meeting later this week. And typically in January of every year, council will lay out the calendar for the future year ahead. So in January for 2020, we'll do the same thing. So this Tuesday meeting's been planned for a long time.
All right. So you're going somewhere for this meeting to Colorado?
Not myself. I believe a few of the council members will be going to, I think it's Aspen this year. We've obviously just had folks like Breckenridge and Frisco and all sorts of people in town for the Mountain Towns 2030. And so there was a lot of excitement for this meeting in Aspen coming up.
Okay. Do you have any, where the agenda or anything?
I'm not actually, I apologize. Since I'm not attending, I'm focusing on what's happening here internally, and that's been my focus.
Okay. Work session at 4 o'clock. The council will review the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant contracts, those already approved and those still that need to be approved. And we hear in the staff report that it is a comprehensive and complex project. Still, it looks like the city has already approved more than $15 million and estimates that we will be signing contracts totaling more than $100 million.
So you took the words right out of my mouth, complex and very, very expensive. And that $15 million that's been approved thus far that hasn't been spent, the bulk of that is very, very scientific engineering, machinery quotes and estimates, all sorts of planning and design to make a state-of-the-art, brand-new water treatment plant. I'm sure the majority of our community knows that we have an extremely complicated treatment system as a result of taking our water out of the mines. We're also under a compliance order from state entities for mine water treatment. And because of that, when you put those two together, we've got this very, very complex, very, very sophisticated project that we'll be bringing online in the next 2 years. And council's asked for sort of more regular updates and more comparative analysis about what we're budgeting versus what's coming in for construction contracts, planning contracts, engineering contracts, and design contracts. And so over time, you'll see staff reporting in when we get bids, when we're actually signing contracts, how those compare to our estimates.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this sounds like about $30 million more than what we originally thought that this project might cost. So what's going on there?
Well, it's funny that you say that. So this has gone back and forth. When I started with the city about 6 years ago, the project was even more expensive, believe it or not. And we went back to the drawing board with the state, and we actually made a plea and said that this isn't fair to our ratepayers. The cost was exorbitant, and we didn't think that the ratepayers could support it. Fortunately, they were sensitive to our argument, but 2 years ago, we renegotiated our treatment philosophy, the size and the scope of the treatment facility, and we were actually able to reduce costs. I don't have the exact amount, but believe it or not, it's hard to believe it was actually going to be more expensive had we not doubled down and worked with the state.
So how does it get paid for? I mean, it's hard to believe that a city of 8,000 people can afford a $100 million infrastructure project.
It gets paid by, believe it or not, it gets paid by the ratepayers. We're obviously very fortunate to have the resort economy and a lot of second homeowners that are paying investment rates and for investment property. And so believe it or not, the ratepayers pay for this. I think typically over time, we have had relatively low water rates in Park City. And so now that we've been raising them over time, we have a water model, a funding model that can pay for this.
At 4:25, the council is scheduled to receive an update on the Transportation Demand Management Program and a progress report. Can you outline what are the most effective strategies we have used to try and ease traffic congestion?
So, you know, by and large, this is the second report. So about 3 weeks ago, and I was here on the radio, we had a staff communications report, which is a component of our agenda, where we highlight something. We don't necessarily plan on going at length and talking about it, but we want to share it with the community and share it with council in the event that it raises interest and we need to do a deeper dive. And so council asked for a deeper dive. So this is by and large the same report. But in terms of the most effective things that we've done, I think by far and away the frequency of our electric express, the white express, and then our bike share program are two kind of shining stars of how we've been shifting demand, getting more people into our transit system, and then our paid parking program downtown. I think it's easy to say that you're going to have more efficient transit service and better headways and make things more convenient. But if there's no incentive or disincentive to not just drive into town at the busiest times of the year, it's going to be hard to make that model work.
Yeah. So we know that the paid parking program has done what it wanted to do, and that is basically keeping the employees from using the parking garage and parking spots. But we also had heard like the bike share program, ridership down. Do we know our bus transit? I mean, are we lot of times you look at one of those electric buses and they're empty.
No, that's a very fair question. Fortunately, we've had year-over-year increases, I believe, for the last 4 years in our transit system. And I think by and large, this is the result of sort of wrapping a lot of different strategies together. So paid parking, better levels of service. We have our resort partners working with us. We have employee parking programs. And there's no silver bullet. You know, it's going to take a lot of different strategies over time. But by and large, year over year, the last 3.5, 4 years, we've had an increase in transit service, and we're very proud of that. But we have a long way to go.
Where are we with the Wasatch County Transit Study?
Good question. So that's in the report that's coming before council tomorrow evening, and that's just underway. And the Council of Governments in Wasatch County is leading that discussion. There is some sensitivity about Park City's role in that. So we've just been supportive. We're in the cockpit. We're not driving the plane, but we're very, very supportive. I don't know the timing of the report out on that, but we're also very, very excited for something like that to take place.
As I recall, Park City was like the lead financial contributor to this study.
I believe we may have been. I don't remember the exact amount. I don't believe it was a lot of money, but we think we have a great interest in this and will derive, you know, arguably some of the greatest benefit if we can get more people out of their cars, more people riding our transit system. I was here a few weeks ago talking about a park and ride at the intersection of 248 and 40. And so there could be a great benefit derived to our community from keeping single occupancy vehicle cars off of that corridor.
In progress are plans for bike parking areas. Do we have the easements that are needed to provide bike parking at some of the bus stops?
I believe so. I wasn't aware that was a concern. I believe so. And we obviously have several new stations around town up in Deer Valley, and they've been successful. I know that the ridership was down a little bit this year. We had some technology issues, but I think we're very, very encouraged about expanding this system. There's a new station over by Parley's Elementary School, and my family and I have been using that, so we're excited.
Oh, I was thinking that this was building areas where people could ride their bike, leave it in a safe place and get onto the bus. So you're talking about the bike share program.
Well, we may be passing each other here in our conversation. I'm not sure. I know that we're interested in both. We have done a lot for additional bike facilities, particularly around Main Street and transit areas. But this past year, we also expanded our bike share program.
Okay. What about the targets? The council a couple weeks ago approving that $25,000 annual contract with Ride Amigos.
So, you know, we're really excited about this. I had alluded to in the past, I was familiar with this piece of software working in the Boston metropolitan area, but this is a wonderful program for employees and employers in our community to work together to change travel modes and to shift travel behaviors. So by way of an example, my old employer would incentivize our workforce, and that time was around 2,700 employees, at different times of the week and at peak periods to either walk, to carpool, to bike, and then they can provide you incentive programs, reward programs, or even just compensation to change your travel behavior to impact the system positively. And so we really like the fact that we're working with the resorts, and it has the availability for additional employers in town to join us down the road.
Let's see. Council will also hear from the Summit County Complete Count Census Committee. What's the city's role in this, if anything?
The city's role is to amplify this message, to make sure that the community understands that every 10 years the decennial census is collected, and it's incredibly important for jurisdictions to ensure that they are represented. Importantly, I think in 2010, I believe Utah lost a congressional seat by, it was 80 or 800, I can't recall, residents in the state. And as someone who's worked in Washington, D.C. before, I greatly understand the importance of having that extra congressional seat. It goes a long way in terms of education dollars, social service dollars, infrastructure dollars. So we want to make sure that every resident in Summit County is counted and every resident in Park City is counted. And so to the extent that we can assist with the amplification of the message and what's going on, we want to use council meetings and our platform to do that.
Staff's also proposing a new residential parking program for what's being called Zone G. Basically, we're talking about no street parking from Colesport to 10th Street. Is this winter only?
I don't believe it's winter only. I just think the two key initiatives are, it was resident initiated. We had a bunch of complaints from residents in that area. We're trying to be responsive to, you know, the balance of being right next to the resort and a lot of trickle down and overflow parking. And then we're using the council meeting to amplify that message again and make sure that it's one last opportunity for residents in that area to be aware of it. We've had a couple public sessions. I believe actually the manager has the authority under our code to execute the residential permit parking program, but we wanted to make sure that we were using one more opportunity to let folks know.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about that, because it brings up similar issues with what we saw at Deer Valley Resort last winter. I mean, all of us pay to build the street, to pave the street, to maintain the streets, and yet we can't park on our streets?
Well, no, it's a good question, and I think all of us is true, and it's businesses, it's residents, it's visitors, it's tourists, and so all of us do. But this particular program is to protect residential neighborhoods and neighborhoods. And so this is something that was resident initiated. We received lots of complaints from that area about overflow parking and traffic concerns. And they were seeking a similar system to the parts of town that are south of there that had already had residential parking in place. And so most residents, I understand there's obviously some conveniences when you're having parties or people over, but most residents in this area were seeking this type of residential protection or quality of life protection. And, you know, we're always trying to strike a balance between the commercial interest in town, the tourism interest in town, and our quality of life.
So basically, residents pay for the streets but can't park on the streets under this program unless you have a residential permit. So have to have that Park Avenue address to park there?
That's right. So residents can park on their streets, and they will be able to purchase a permit to park on their street. And this will preclude day skier parking, tourism-type parking, special event parking, and it will, you know, provide that little sanctity of space for those residents to have that quality of life where they've found some disruption in the past and they've sought a better balance from the city.
Let's see, $256,000 annual contract to provide special event and peak time period transportation operations and personnel. What's this for, like Sundance? Are we paying to bring more people on staff?
No, so it's the full Monty. This is for... by and large, our year's worth of special event services, where we have all sorts of different departments that are requiring extra labor and extra services for pedestrian management, traffic control, parking management, public safety. And instead of having 6 to 12 different small contracts, we're trying to create an economy of scale with a known entity that understands how Park City operates and works during a special event. And so this is something that staff's trying. This would be year one. We've never done this before. We've always had a bunch of different contracts in public works and the parking department and the transit department and the special events department. But we're trying to create economy of scale and then bring in a known commodity that understands how the system works and then regular employees that are reoccurringly working in Park City and understand our demands and our traffic flows and the public safety needs that we have.
So does that cost then get pushed on to the special event?
A lot of it does.
All right. Finally, wanted to ask you about last week we had reported on the city's policy for beaver trapping. And we had heard that the beavers were causing flooding and property damage. And it was city policy to trap and euthanize the animals. Is that a new policy or is that something that's been on the books for a while?
It's something that's been on the books for a while. I was obviously aware of it before I was before I became the acting manager. Staff's done a lot of work over the years in this area. And I met with the folks that were working on this program last week, and they told some tall tales of being waist deep or chest deep in water and raking dams and trying to kind of move our resident beavers on down the river. And so they had done a lot of work, and this is sort of their last resort, believe it or not. The men and women that work in our parks department and grounds department, they understand that we're in their environment, but we did have some property loss in terms of flooding and some public infrastructure concerns. And so this is a policy we've had in place in a long time. It was an absolute last resort. But I think the message here is we had a wonderful outcome. We had a few residents that had even deeper contacts in wildlife organizations that we did, and they found a relocation program. I believe it was at Utah State. That's relatively new. I think it's in its infancy. It's only about 12 months old. And so we were even unaware of it. And now we're able to, in the event we need to trap a beaver, we can relocate that beaver.
Yeah. And I guess that's what there's some concern about, the fact that the mayor and council members, none of them seem to know that that this was even going on. I mean, is that something that needs to go through the council?
I don't believe it does. Believe it or not, we have other programs. We have a rodent program on Main Street. We have all sorts of things that happen on our golf course and other parks and properties. But by and large, we're very, very sensitive that we live in the mountains, that we are in a wildlife habitat, and so we try to be extremely sensitive. However, this was a last case resort that fortunately had a very good outcome.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
The only other thing I'll mention is we have been trying to get additional feedback on our closed captioning software for city council meetings. As the public knows, at any time council is meeting in an open session, you can stream that session live, and we have a closed captioning service. And council, before they re-up the new contract for this type of service, is interested in getting feedback from the public.
Okay. Matt, thanks.
Thanks.
That's Interim City Manager Matt Dias. It's 8:52. Joining me now in the studio, Brian Hatton, Director of the Siderville Basin Special Recreation District. Good morning.
Good morning.
Some cute video last week of goats being released on Willow Creek open space. Are they still there in the snow?
I think so. I didn't go by this weekend with all the snow, but that's was going to be one of my first questions when I go in the office today, was to find out if they're still fighting this the climate.
Yeah. So why do we have them there?
Basically for weed mitigation. There's a new weed called the prickly lettuce. There's some others, the thistle and the Dyer's woad. But supposedly the prickly lettuce is a quick spreading weed. And so the hopes are, instead of having to spray herbicide and all the chemical out there, we're doing a little trial of about 2 weeks with the goats. There's between 200 and 300 goats out there, and they eat from the top down and all of the spores that maybe fall on the ground. So the hope is that they'll kind of take care of everything there, and then the native grasses will fight their way back.
Okay. How much does that cost to rent 300 goats?
Unfortunately, I don't have that number in front of me, but I know it's cheaper than what the herbicide and what the wages would have been to get somebody to go out and spray or have our staff do it themselves. So, kind of a new technique. Our trails in open space have definitely kind of stepped outside of the box and trying different ways to mitigate the spread of the weed.
Okay. Let's see. You're working on the Toll Creek Stream Restoration Project. How are things going there?
They start out November 1st. The plan is to go up there, and they're going to put in 4 analog dams. The hope for that would be just to help the setting of the stream, and it'll help with the refuge for wildlife. It'll help with some fire resilience. The plan is, on the 1st, was to go up early. There's on our website, you can sign up or find a little bit more information about what's going on. And there's going to be a little work involved, but we're looking for volunteers to come help with that as well.
Oh, sounds like Park City has some beavers you could use.
I know. You never know. We might work out a deal here.
All right. County Council's agenda had an item for the Recreation District proposed tax increase. We're talking about a 72% increase. That seems so huge.
It does. And I definitely understand there's going to be impacts, or if it does go through. It's been since, we haven't done anything since 2004. And since then, we've added 2 community parks. We started with, in 2004, we had 66 acres of open space, and now we have over 2,200 acres of open space. And a lot of 84% of the amenities we have are non-revenue generating. So we need to find ways to take care of these. And the biggest looks for what we're doing with this are capital improvements to our facilities, both preparing for the future as well as taking care of what we currently have. A lot of our facilities are aging, and we want to make sure we're providing a quality service for what the community expects.
Yeah. So what facilities are you talking about? Do you have a list of priorities?
We're going through our community survey. We're finishing our needs assessment, and our next step will be our strategic action plan. And with that, we hope to set that plan.
Well, I mean specifically with regard to those capital improvements.
Oh, yes.
Existing facilities.
Yeah, absolutely. Our playgrounds, we replaced one this year. Willow Creek Park is another one that we're looking to replace in the next couple of years. We know Matt Canoop doesn't seem old, but it gets a lot of love. The field at Matt Canoop Park is in need of repair in a couple of years. So there's lots of little things that we can tick off with this increase.
Okay, so this $2.4 million, it's an annual increase then?
It is, yes.
Yeah, and what would that do to somebody's property tax bill?
So it's $12.82 per $100,000 assessed or market value. So if you're looking at a $800,000 home, which is kind of the median price, it's about $100 a year increase.
Okay. And that you couldn't just go up to take account for the new growth?
That doesn't give us enough finances. I mean, there are, we do receive impact fees from that, but it's not enough to make up for the 15 years of what we have put into our facilities.
Okay. And then what's next for that?
For what?
I mean, has it been approved? Will it?
Oh, no. We will go on December 4th. We go in front of the county council for, there'll be a public hearing so people can have a chance to come out and speak. And then they will approve, finalize our budget, and that's part of our budget hearing as well.
Okay. You've got some youth sports starting up this week?
Yeah. If anyone's looking for activities for their kids, we have a Bigfoot soccer indoor at the field house for third grade to eighth grade. Basin Baller League, it's the first year we're doing a high school basketball league. Little Dribblers is a youth basketball league, 4 years old to second grade. And our volleyball program runs from, like, I think, 7 year olds to 12 year olds.
Okay.
So a lot of options to choose from if they're looking for something to do for their kids.
All right. And that's all done in the field house?
All are done in the field house.
Okay. And then coming up this Saturday, you've got the Trick or Treat.
Yeah, our Celebrate the Spirits Trick or Treat Run. It's a fun event if you haven't done it, but it's, you come dressed in your costumes and get out and run, and all of the proceeds go to our scholarship fund, so you're going for a good cause. And it was the first, I still say it's the first time my kids actually ran a 5K, because they didn't realize they were running. We have candy stations set up along the trail, and they just go. They don't realize what they're doing because they're so focused on the candy.
Yeah, it's a 5K?
There's a 5K and a 1 mile. So
okay.
Depending on what you choose, or you can turn around at any time, just depending on how your little ghoul or goblin is doing.
Okay. Registration online then?
Yep. You can find that at basinrecreation.org.
Okay. Anything else?
Nope. That should be it.
All right, Brian. We'll see you next month. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
It's Brian Hatton, District Director of the Snyderville Basin Recreation District. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.